Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, February 6th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, professor and Futures Lab director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Each week, we consider what the American media cover and how they cover it. Here to help are regular panelists and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. We're going to touch on several topics today. How well did CBS handle that 34-minute power outage at the Superdome? What were some of the best and worst Super Bowl commercials? And how did some of the most clever sponsors take advantage of the dimmed lights through social media? We'll update you on a couple of previous stories, the Scientology-fueled controversy over sponsored content at the Atlantic, and ongoing fallout from the CNET ban. Chinese hackers are apparently targeting American journalists, and the latest Pew Center News IQ quiz shows Americans know more about religion and business than they do politics. Many storylines emerged from the Super Bowl last Sunday night. Perhaps the least well understood is why half the lights and power to the press box went out for more than 30 minutes just after the start of the third quarter. Equally obscure, at least to many critics, is why CBS didn't call on its vaunted news team rather than let its sports anchors flounder in the dark. Lee, first of all, about CBS deciding, you know, not to call on its news team, that not doing a particularly good job in the or those minutes of telling us what was going on, was the criticism justified, you think?
I thought the criticism was a little bit over the top. Quite frankly, it did not occur to me until we were 10 or 15 minutes into the blackout that it was possible that this could have been a terrorist act. I think in some way that's a measure of how far the country has come in the past decade. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing, that that wasn't the first conclusion that we all leapt to. Having said all of that, having laid that as a foundation, how they handled it in some ways was really quite puzzling because they certainly had people that they could call on. And in fact, other news organizations, there's a link on the blog, the New Orleans Times-Picayune did a really great job of treating it as a news story and sort of trying to get to the bottom of whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, Charles, some of the overheated criticism about, well, what if it had been a terrorist attack had been dispelled pretty early on. I mean, when they didn't do a very good job if they only knocked out half the lights. But still, I'd have to say, why didn't CBS have a contingency plan? Why wasn't somebody in the newsroom in either New York or somebody down in New Orleans able to jump in and at least ask a question of the mayor or somebody from the NFL or from the energy company? They were all there at the Superdome.
Yeah, I mean, I just wish somebody would have stuck a microphone in. At some point, one of the Harbaugh brothers was screaming at some NFL officials. And, I mean, he was clearly just unbelievably upset, the Baltimore Harbaugh brother. I can't keep him straight. I was just hoping that somebody would stick a microphone over there so I could hear what he was saying because I think it was gold. But, you know, there's been criticism in the wake where people are saying they should have had the head of the energy company that ran the power. Oh, come on. The lights went out in the middle of the Super Bowl. It's not the middle of a city council meeting. I mean, it's a sporting event. And so you kind of have to roll with it as a sporting event. It would have been nice had they like cut to New York probably and done a brief 10-minute headlines probably sort of thing. And I would imagine in the wake of this, there'll be sort of the Department of Unforeseen Circumstances that will pop up and they'll have like a plan B because they've never had to do it before. But, you know, a power outage was bound to happen.
Is it unfair to speculate that maybe CBS didn't feel particularly motivated to want to dig really deeply during the Super Bowl broadcast itself with millions and millions of dollars in revenue on the line, asking all those tough questions, trying to force an NFL spokesperson to say something?
I don't know that they could have forced an NFL person to say something. I think finding them in that crowd might have been a little difficult, even though you could have probably known which of the very expensive boxes they were most likely to have been in. But I think having some sort of a plan B so that we're not – that the crowd isn't sitting there, the audience isn't sitting at home sort of going, "Wee, I've got 34 minutes here to make more chicken wings, go to the restroom, whatever it is that you need to – that you normally do during commercial breaks at the Super Bowl, that now you've got this 34-minute window to do."
I don't think it's all that surprising, Charles, but it was kind of interesting to see how the sideline reporters, the word they use, are really great at ad-libbing about, first downs and injuries and all that kind of stuff. Not so good at ad-libbing when it comes to, "Hey, the lights just went out. Why did this happen? When are they coming back on?"
As the great George Kennedy often says, they subtracted from the sum of human knowledge. it was painful to watch how clueless they were. You would have thought they could at least gotten – Moonves says – in a lot of the day after coverage that the NFL told him it would be less than 20 minutes, which is why they didn't switch over. Well, you don't think one of those sideline reporters could have asked one of the – there were NFL officials all over both sidelines and gotten that little nugget?
Right. Well, 5 seconds of awkward dead silence is death on television.
Yes.
So if you thought you're going to be down for 20 minutes, rise to the occasion a little better, maybe. Well, handicapping the announcers or even the teams that are actually playing the game is lots of fun, of course, but many Americans actually spend more time commenting on the commercials. This year was no different, and we enjoy the ad game as much as anybody, so we're going to get to some of our favorite spots in a moment. But let's start with a company that always generates lots of negative pushback, GoDaddy.com.
Rides to GoDaddy. There's the sexy side represented by Bar Raffaelli, and the smart side that creates a killer website for your small business represented by Walter. Together, they're perfect.
That kiss goes on for quite a long time after that. Sexist, maybe. Gross, probably. Was it effective, Lee, in trying to say, GoDaddy has this image of sexiness, but we really can help get your business online with the nerds that are behind the scenes?
I appreciate the nerds that are behind the scenes. I'm not sure that this got anybody to access this particular firm any more than they would have been inclined to before. GoDaddy commercials have always historically just plain puzzled me because I don't see how they're actually being successful at selling anything.
And yet, Charles, I can agree with everything that Lee said except for maybe the very last part. They are the only company I bet anybody can name in the internet service provider business of all the companies that are out there. Anybody, you say, who can I go to put together a web page? GoDaddy.com.
Yeah, they've got the overheated 14-year-old male demographic just nailed down. I don't know beyond that who was not repulsed by that ad.
Well, any other duds that pop into your heads from the Super Bowl?
Well, we didn't see the Scientology ad in our market. I watched it online and found it baffling.
Let's save that one for a minute because I'm going to bring that up for some special consideration in a minute. I thought, Lee, at least one other that struck me as puzzling was the ad for BlackBerry, for their new BlackBerry 10.
Yeah. I was going to bring that
the
up.
Commercial was all the things it doesn't do. Does that make me want to buy one, especially with iPhone and Android and all the other choices that are out? That was just a weird ad. Well, Charles, you picked as one of your favorites an ad for Jeep. It was narrated by Oprah Winfrey, and it features the vehicle and scenes of American soldiers coming home to their families.
"You've been missed. You've been needed. You've been cried for, prayed for. You've been the reason we push on."
This ad and another from Jeep featuring an old radio commentary from Paul Harvey extolling the virtue of American farmers also scored very well with people who were rating it online. And Charles, is this anything more than just an obvious appeal to patriotism? What did you like about it?
That it's an obvious appeal to patriotism. It's Americana. And it's Jeep. Jeep is a brand, kind of ubiquitous military brand with great ties to the U.S. military. And so I thought the cinematography, the music, and of course having Oprah doing the narration. It was just a beautiful piece of advertising. Did you think the Dodge ad with the Paul Harvey extolling the virtues of farmers for their truck, was that as effective? Did that work?
I liked it a lot. And in the Super Bowl social gathering I was at, it stopped conversation cold. So did the GoDaddy ad, but for different reasons. But it stopped. It's literally people turned around and looked to see what was going on. And that's as an advertiser, what you want to happen.
Obviously, an appeal to patriotism and American values works and has worked for many years. Lee, one of the ads that you said you liked the best focused on humor, another one of those standard ploys for getting us to watch. This one was from Toyota, the RAV4, and it features a genie granting wishes.
Anderson family, I'm your RAV4 genie. Your wish is my command.
I wish the old spare tire was gone.
Really? Out of everything? And the okay.
Oh no, I'm.
I wish animals could talk.
Much better.
I wish the old spare tire was gone.
Oh, I wish I could eat as much chocolate as I want.
Well, your chocolate levels are dangerously low. Now Gladys is going to start you on a chocolate IV, and here are some free samples.
While mom and kids get just what they want, the hapless dad is harassed by infinite witches rather than infinite wishes, and he has to work out with the genie and her little dog to lose his beer gut. So, Lee, it was funny. Was it effective, you think?
I don't know if it was effective. It sure did make me stop and look. And one of the things that I really liked about it is that it plays on some other American cultural things, so that the person who is in the ad, the spokeswoman, is somebody from a very popular television show. She, in turn, is making fun of Legally Blonde. So, you know, you sort of have pop culture on top of pop culture on top of pop culture in that ad. And actually, that was what I thought gave it a lot of its humor value.
At least there were lots of shots of the RAV4 in the commercial. I'm not quite sure whether or not it would make me want to buy one or not, but it certainly at least had the brand front and center. Well, most viewers and critics seem to agree that one of my favorite Super Bowl ads was at least quite clever. It was the whisper fight that breaks out in a library over the best part of an Oreo cookie.
I've always preferred the cream part of an Oreo.
That's crazy. The cookie's the best part.
Cream.
Cookie.
Cream.
Cookie.
Cream.
Cookie.
Cream.
Cookie.
Cream.
Cookie.
Cream.
Cream. Fire.
Cream.
Cookie.
I'm calling the cops.
Cream.
Cream.
You guys have to stop fighting. We're the cops.
Choose your side on Instagram at Oreo.
We apologize to our radio-only listeners. It loses a little something without the video. But at the end of the commercial, Oreo encourages you to take sides through the social media photo site Instagram. Oreo was also one of the sponsors to react most quickly and effectively, Charles, when the power went out at the Superdome. They used Twitter to post a picture of a cookie with the tagline, "You can still dunk in the dark." There were some others that we all saw. Buffalo Wild Wings, for example, used Twitter to try to take tongue-in-cheek credit for the power outage. Calvin Klein tweeted an 8-second looping video of a hunky guy doing crunches in his underwear. And PBS even used Twitter to encourage viewers to abandon the Super Bowl and watch Downton Abbey instead. So I'm wondering what you think about the use of social media this year with the ads.
I thought it was brilliant and inspired for all of those different social media mavens, for all those corporations to suddenly simultaneously go, oh, an opportunity. And so you see Tide, for example, which not only ran, which not only tweeted about the blackout, but put together a quick still spot referring to the blackout that people were in the middle of experiencing collectively at that moment. That's inspired work. And it sort of tells us where we're headed to some extent into that second screen environment, where we're just going to get more and more creative about using that back and forth between the TV exposure and the Twitter exposure.
I mean, I think ironically, it also shows us that some of the advertisers were better prepared than CBS to take advantage of or deal with the power outage. You know, Lee, one of the things that we noticed, the statistics that were gathered after the Super Bowl, showed that more than a third of the ads included a Twitter hashtag. Super Bowl was the most social live event ever. There were more than 30 million comments on Twitter, Facebook, and other platforms. And we call it now the second screen experience. It's really helping broadcast TV because it's encouraging people to watch more TV live. Why does that matter?
It matters because if you're watching it live, you get the commercial. And then when you have a second screen experience, you get to comment about the commercial. I think this is referred to in the very olden days as free media. Or if you don't like that, we just now call it buzz. But the point is that whatever it is you're paying for your commercial exposure, and in the Super Bowl, I think that was something like $3.7 million per 30 seconds. You're getting more exposure by virtue of the people who are treating and retreating, or you know, or what have you. So, in that sense, I think it's terrific. The other thing it reminds me of is that, you know, way back in the dark ages, that's not a pun on the blackout. Someone actually took a stopwatch to the Super Bowl and discovered that the thing that the television spent the very most time on was the clock. And so somebody has apparently read something like that and said, you know, there's an awful lot of unused media space here. Let's see what we can do with the ads.
Broadcasters are really investing a lot now in the past few months in the second screen experience. And I think obviously for the reasons you suggest, you're going to watch the commercials if you're not DVRing the event. You're not going to DVR a basketball game or a football game or the Oscars or whatever. I wonder, though, whether it can help us with news broadcasts when we're not covering something big like the presidential election or the boy in the bunker in Alabama or whatever. Well, before we leave the topic of Super Bowl commercials altogether, let's talk for just a moment about an ad that ran regionally, not nationally. It was only seen in a few selected cities like New York, LA, San Francisco, and Dallas. The sponsor, the Church of Scientology.
Powerful beyond measure, and the fuel of that power is not magic or mysticism, but knowledge. The things you see, the things you feel, the things you know to be true. Sure, some will doubt you. Let them. Dare to think for yourself, to look for yourself, to make up your own mind. Because in the eternal debate for answers, the one thing that's true is what's true for you.
It's interesting. We were watching this ad together and all thought we noticed a very brief image of the columns from the MU campus there. Don't know if they were or not. But Charles, why does the Church of Scientology want to run this ad now? Why during the Super Bowl? Why only in some cities?
Well, against the context of what a couple of shows ago we were having this conversation about Scientology, there are some very high-profile critics of Scientology that have emerged. I mean, there always have been, but more so than ever. The New York Times reportage, the book that's come out very recently by the former Scientologist. And so I think this must be some sort of public relations pushback. I would greatly question its effectiveness. I watched that ad two or three times and still can't conclude what it is they're saying other than come join us, I guess, which is, I don't know.
Well, but if you're a free thinker, if you're a creative person, you know, we're not scary. We're a bunch of people just like you who are really smart, is what it seemed like it was saying. I don't know if it was effective or not, but it had a lot of production values, and it certainly had a style that was targeted at the audience they were going for, urban, probably younger people.
Well, it was targeted at the audience they were going for, but I sort of thought until you got to the Scientology tagline, if I had not known that this was about Scientology before I sat down to watch it, I could have put many things in there. Udacity, University of Missouri, your local public library. All of that would have actually fit with the ad that they created. And so in that sense, I didn't get the sense of come join me. I sort of got the sense of, well, maybe we're not scary, but again, it's kind of how you come to it. And I came to it knowing that this was a Scientology ad. So I think my guard was up in a different way.
Well, Scientology was also involved in a story that we'd like to update from a couple of weeks ago. You'll recall the controversy surrounding the Atlantic magazine. They were running a so-called sponsored content or advertorials. But they were running them in their online news space, looked a lot like a news article, but they were touting the accomplishments of Scientology paid for by the Church of Scientology. And when readers started slamming this advertorial with negative comments, the Atlantic's marketing department deleted them. Well, this week, the Atlantic released new guidelines for how they handle future ads that masquerade as news stories, I would say anyway. First, there will be a more rigorous screening process to make sure that prospective advertisers are, quote, consistent with the publication's brand, meaning probably not the Church of Scientology. Second, the labeling of the sponsored content will be more prominent than it was. And third, that comments will only be deleted if they include spam, obscenity, or hate speech. So, Charles, too little too late, or should we praise them for coming forward so quickly with some rules that other journalists might want to follow?
I'd praise them for getting their act together and coming out with some rules and being transparent about how they arrived at them as well. I mean, there was a fair bit of context with these rules. They didn't just sort of walk down from the mountaintop and issue them to the employee base. They were pretty clear about how they got there, and I thought that was an admirable process.
Leah, why are publishers, and again, maybe this is obvious to most people, but why are they more heavily involved in these so-called native ads or sponsored content now than, say, a few years ago?
Well, because it looks like on the surface that it is a, quote, untapped or incompletely tapped revenue stream. I do want to point out that the New York Times, which does this, does it in-house. They have their own department that you have to work with, go through, and pay for if you want to have an advertorial in the New York Times. So it's not as if it hasn't been out there for a while. I agree completely with Charles. I applaud The Atlantic for doing this. I think Scientology figured out that what it wanted was the Atlantic demographic, meaning income level. But I think The Atlantic looked at it and said, you know, there's something else about our brand here and about our content that's not just strictly advertising based mm-hmm. that we need to be a little protective of.
Let's give another quick update from past weeks. You'll remember, of course, the CBS decision to censor its own technology news service, CNET. Well, CES, that's the Consumer Electronics Show, that giant trade show in Las Vegas every year. Well, they have now decided they will no longer partner with CNET as a result of the controversy over the prize that was given and then taken back. So what, Lee? Is this a big deal? Should we care? Is it just more obvious fallout? Is it the end of the fallout?
I don't know if it's the end of the fallout. What I would say is here is another manifestation of what the web can do for you. The fact of the matter is that electronic show, which gets huge coverage in mainstream as well as online media, it doesn't need to partner with CNET. It doesn't need to partner with CBS. It has plenty of outlets out there without any of that. So it's basically, I think, a pretty easy choice for them to make.
You know, we also mentioned last week, Charles, that CBS's decision might affect attempts by other media companies and the FCC's chairman to allow mergers of newspaper outlets and broadcasters in some cities. Well, there's another potential loser, as it turns out. Bloomberg is reporting this week it would be Rupert Murdoch. His News Corp would very much like to buy the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, but because they already own TV stations in those markets, they can't unless the rules are changed.
Yeah, and they're right up on the – I know – Murdoch's right up on the limit for broadcast ownership overall as well. The timing of it could not have been worse. And CBS comes off looking like a bully, and not only looking like a bully, but looking like a bully in a three-channel universe.
Yeah. Well, let's look very briefly at a couple of other items that caught our attention this week. First, Lee, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post all reported that they'd been the victims of Chinese computer hackers. The papers say it appears the hackers were trying they were tied to the Chinese government, first of all, and that they may have been trying to keep tabs on journalists and their sources in stories that embarrassed some of the party leaders. So the Chinese government, of course, is denying the hacking, but lots of cybersecurity specialists hired by the papers or quoted by the papers say they're pretty certain of the source.
I was glad to see the journalism around these stories because it said a couple of things to me. The first one is that when you get any reporting out of China of the sort that the New York Times has been doing, you're always, I think, a little bit skeptical because it's a tough place to report. You don't know. You can't validate sources or documents in the same way. So one of the things this did for me, in essence, was to say, New York Times, you really did get it right. You got it so right that you made these people angry and upset. The question that I have left is, well, I actually have two. I really would like to know how much these major news organizations are spending to defend themselves in this way. We talk about media economics. We talk about pay and paywalls and all this other sort of stuff. But until this began to happen, I didn't realize that this actually probably constitutes a significant outlay of which, you know, subscriptions and advertisings are going to be very pushed to pay for. And the second is, if there's pushback on this, how does this news then get back into China? China.
Yeah, I mean, the real problem, Charles, is going to cost these news organizations more. I don't know if you can ever finally get ahead of hackers. They're awfully smart. But the real chilling effect is going to be on dissidents and others who would be sources in China for American journalists. I mean, they don't have to just worry about it costing a bit more. They have to worry about going to prison or worse.
I mean, imagine being a Chinese dissident and reading the New York Times coverage of the hacking. You would be scared to death at the lengths to which the Chinese government, I'm guessing, was going to try to infiltrate the Times. It was absolutely riveting piece of journalism. If you haven't seen it, it's fascinating. I mean, among other things, they say it very nonchalantly, we just let them in and then followed them around for a while in our system so that we could learn more about them, which was amazing.
Well, speaking of international news, we know from a variety of surveys and experiments over the years that Americans are not exactly top of the class when it comes to knowledge about the rest of the world or sometimes even our own country's political system. Well, the latest poll comes from the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. It consists of 13 questions referring to newsworthy pictures, graphs, and symbols. You can take the survey online. There's a link to it on our blog. And as an example, for our video viewers at least, here are three questions. We're going to pull them up on the screen. Charles and Lee and I are going to have a look. The first one says, what currency does this symbol represent? It's a letter C with some horizontal lines through them. Is it the dollar, the euro, the pound, or the yen? Okay, we're going to wait for a second. Everybody, it's the Lee.
It's the euro.
It's the euro. Okay, let's look at the next question. This question says, in which of these states did voters in 2012 approve the legalization of same-sex marriage? You can choose from Florida, Ohio, Texas, or Washington. Charles, a correct answer is?
Washington.
Washington. And one more question.
That was nerve-wracking.
Which of these is the flag of the People's Republic of China? Well, and there, you'll see four different flags there. It's the one with the red background, a large yellow star, and four smaller stars around it to the right. And that's three of 13 questions that are there. Well, it's kind of interestingly because Americans seem to do pretty well on this survey. I thought 9 out of 10 of us could identify the Star of David as being associated with Judaism. 8 of 10 of us recognize the Twitter logo. But only about half could identify Syria on a map of the Middle East. And about half could pick out the Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, or the new U.S. Senator from Massachusetts from a photo lineup. On average, we got a grade of 65. Is that good or bad? I mean, it would be a D in our book if we were grading them in a class.
Well, it's American. So I did what the news story suggested. I went and I took the quiz before I read the rest of it. And I have to admit that a couple of them, the flag one, I got by process of elimination. I just said, I know it's not the Amtrak logo. I know it's not this. I know it's not that. Therefore, it must be, you know, this other thing here. And so and so there's some of that going on. But I think also if you look at what's in the news, okay, when we run stories about Syria, we hardly ever run the map. And we hardly ever run any description about geopolitically why this is important. So in some sense, it makes some sense.
I did think that, you know, maybe some of us can actually respond better to these kinds of questions when there is something visual to stimulate us. And maybe that's why we might have done a little better. Well, there were a couple of other topics we wanted to get to today. Lee brought to our attention, for example, the New York Times having to reissue its obituary of former Mayor Ed Koch because somehow or another, the Times just left out the fact that he'd been significantly criticized during the 1980s for how he handled or did not handle the AIDS epidemic in his city. And I also thought we might talk about Skeet Gate, but we won't have a time to, whether or not the media should have been so fascinated with President Obama and whether or not he is a skeet shooter. There are links on our blog if you'd like to explore those topics more. Well, that half hour zoomed by awfully fast, so we just have time for a few thank yous. First, we'll thank you, of course, for listening and watching. Don't forget to check out links to audio and video and stories on our blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. If you'd like to send us questions, comments, or suggestions, write us at views@kbia.org. Thanks to Director Travis McMillan from RJI and audio engineer Pat Akers from KBIA. And thanks, of course, to Lee and Charles. I'm Mike McKean. I'll be away next week, so join Lee when she takes the helm for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.